Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I also appreciate being part of an experiment. As someone who's at a university, we understand that, that really that takes the pressure off because they can fail, but I'll do my best not to. Good morning, all. I have a special place in my heart for folks in Illinois. I've been, for the past 3 years, commuting back and forth, working with some brilliant people at the State Library, with Tom there at Carley, with lots of different folks, and so I really appreciate you having me. Today I want to talk about sort of a general theme of mine is that about expecting more. You know, always good to give a conclusion. And what that means. I think that we as librarians need to expect more of ourselves, our communities need to expect more of what we do, and we need to expect more out of those institutions that we build and depend on. And once again, not to give away the ending, that is not do more with less. That is not accept the new normal where we, you know, just try and keep the hours open and cut the book budget to zero so that we can try and do something. That's not what I mean. What it really means is that I think that the potential within our field, the potential of libraries is so great, and the need within our communities, within our institutions, within our academies are so great that we really need to become something different and more vital to those communities. That we need to expect more of ourselves so that we can help fill that need and within it get the resources we need to do our job. And so within that, the theme that I'd like to talk about today is that, that service, which lies at the core of what we do, which is our fundamental reason for being, which is our fundamental activity and what we measure our impact on, service is proactive. I think for far too long within the library field, we sort of looked at service as important, and we do it, and when they come to the desk, we give them everything we've got. But we need to understand that sometimes they don't come to the desk. And sometimes they don't even come to their desk. And sometimes when they're at their desk, they don't even know they need us. And we need to be there. And we need to reach out. So, I'll start with a sort of standard line that I've been talking about and around. And that's the mission of librarians. The mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their community. Now, this is a mission statement that I developed as part of a book called The Atlas of New Librarianship, but it really is a way of helping me, and I hope you, think through where we're evolving, where we're becoming. Because a lot of us are really worried, concerned, interested in the future of the field. And so what I started, my sort of personal endeavor looking at this journey to find out what is the future of librarianship and where can we be, this is where I ended up. Now, of course, ironically, in looking for the future, I found a mission that I really think could span the entire 3,000-year history of our field. But I want to point out a few things about this mission. The first is that it's really got two parts. The first part is the mission of librarians is to improve society. And that really is about us reaching out, being proactive, bringing our values into the community, values of privacy, values of openness, values of learning, all of this into that community. And then the second half, through facilitating knowledge creation in communities, is really about those that we serve. And I just want to take a brief moment to explain some language that I'll use throughout it, and that is that I don't talk about patrons because I bet very few librarians who do oil painting for rich people. I don't talk about users because, frankly, you know, computer science and drug dealers have users. And this idea that somehow the only role of someone who walks into our building is to consume and leave, to me, is rather unrewarding. I think that a lot of what librarianship is about is building good citizens. And that includes when they come through college and they're getting a degree and they're worried about economic development, we also have to be worried about them becoming contributors and owners and citizens, and that means there's a responsibility on their part to understand things thoroughly, that they're not simply using and consuming and buying, but that they're actually out shaping and creating and building. So the second part there, through facilitating knowledge, is about the members, right? Our job is to figure out from the members what do they need, what do they want, making sure that our values are expressed in those forms, and then facilitating, working to make that happen. And there's a couple ways in which we facilitate it. The one that we're all sort of used to thinking, particularly in the notion of a consortium, is around access. Right? So when someone wants to learn, we give them access to materials, to books, to things, ultimately to conversations and artifacts, people and ideas, to help them do their job. And a lot of how we geared the profession is around access. We built buildings to improve access to physical things. We've paid for licensed databases to improve access to digital things. We've created a whole suites and schemas of cataloging and metadata to improve finding and discovery of the things. But access alone is insufficient. Access alone is not going to help you learn, right? If I were to say drop you in the middle of, where am I going to drop you? I'll drop you in the middle of China and I'll show up in 3 days. You will not speak Chinese. You need help figuring that out. So access is important, but we also need things like baseline knowledge. Right? We have lots of students who come in that can search Google but can't effectively search through peer-reviewed databases in order to succeed on their projects, in their courses. So we need to provide instruction. We need to provide an understanding of where they're going. We need to understand academics of all stripes, from students to faculty to administrators, need to understand how the flow of scholarly communication works. So knowledge is the second thing that we do when we facilitate. But even having access to the stuff and having an understanding of what's there isn't enough. We need to provide an environment which they feel free to access, where they feel safe. Sometimes that's physical safety. Sometimes our campuses provide a place where people can come and feel physically safe at night and after hours. But most of what we concentrate, particularly in the academic world, is around intellectual safety, that people can explore new ideas and not feel self-conscious. And that's not just controversial topics. It's also the idea that, as we started with, experimentation, that people can pursue ideas that go nowhere, that people can pursue and try things that don't work. And so we need to be able to have people work in an environment where they can try, they can stretch, they can reach, and they can fail. And then they can fail. And then they can fail. But eventually they'll succeed. Right? That's the way that you do great things, is that you try lots of things until one of them works. And every time something fails, you learn that one bit of things to help you forward. So our libraries need to be places that build a safe environment, where they feel physically safe, where they can explore topics, controversy or not, and where they have an ability to fail and to succeed, to fail constructively, if you will. But even that's not enough. Right? So we can get at the conversations, we know sort of the parameters of the conversations, we feel safe in doing that, but does anyone care? Do they want to? So the fourth way in which we facilitate conversations is around motivation. And there are two flavors of motivation. One flavor is intrinsic motivation, and it's the type of motivation that libraries have thrived on for 3,000 years. This is the person is coming because they want to know something. They want to discover the new thing. They want to explore a new book. They want to find some great entertainment. They want to get their doctorate. They want to succeed in school, where the impetus for action comes from themselves. And we love it. And then we built, like I say, a very successful market around intrinsic motivation. But we have to understand there's another type of motivation, which is extrinsic motivation. That is when people do things for external rewards. And we know a lot of these too. I mean, we've all lived through the freshman paper, right? Whatever that class is that has 300 students that come in on the night before it's due and say, I need to do a paper. What do you need? Oh, I've got to do research on this. I mean, you know, you could have written this paper. In fact, you have written this paper 50 times, but you hide it behind the desk and you torture them until they finally come up with, I need to find out how this works. And then we walk them through and we teach them the instruction. Well, that's extrinsic motivation. They're not there for the love of that paper. They're there because they've been told to go there. And you say, well, extrinsic motivation sounds rather horrible. Why would we ever care about extrinsic motivation? But there are actually good reasons to. No one wants to go through a tenure decision, and yet if we can be there and make sure that that's an authentic experience where we can provide data to it, where we can be part of sponsored research. I'm going to talk a little bit more about how we can build ourselves into the workflow of the university. So the mission of librarians, of you, not of the building, not of the organization, not of the org chart, but of you, is to improve that society. The other thing I'll point out that we don't like to talk about, but that is that the mission of a librarian may at some point be different than the mission of the institution they work for and may bring them into direct conflict. And so we have to, we're entering an age where we've disconnected a lot of librarianship from the collection, from the institution, from the building. In essence, to be a librarian these days, you can get access to lots and lots of resources and not have to be part of a big building and an org chart and a budget sheet. So we're going to be increasingly talking about what's my mission and what do I want to accomplish? How does that fit into the organization I'm working with? And then within a consortial environment, how does that fit into the group of people who are working together? And how do we align those things and how do we deal with those missions when they're not aligned? That's a question we're going to deal with. But the other thing I want to point out about this mission is that you could look at this, and as I said, I think people, you know, Ranganathan and folks way back when could look at this and say, yep, that works. That makes sense to me. I can see that. And so this mission doesn't necessarily say we need to do anything differently. It says, you know, we can improve. Sure, we'll improve. How do we do it? Well, you could say, look, the way we improve society is we provide a big building with lots of books, and people come in and read the books and think brilliant thoughts, publish papers, do research, do science, get degrees, get out, get rich, whatever it is, and society improves. In which case, we can be extremely passive, and society will be improved just because we were here. Well, that's not very exciting, and it's also becoming less and less true. Just as librarians have been increasingly disconnected from this collection, so are our scholars. So are our students. I mean, this is more than just, well, they can search Google, blah, 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 because we know Google doesn't really hold the content. It's just a way of finding lots of really good and lots of really bad content on the net. And so we aren't a necessary intermediary. We have to add a value above and beyond simply being the collection. So this mission is about what we're trying to do, but it doesn't really get to the heart of it, which is, what are we trying to do? I mean, improve society is fine, but what does that mean? How active is that? And this became very clear to me because I recently had the privilege of attending a seminar. It was in Salzburg, which, by the way, did not suck. Though you had to climb mountains, and every mountain. But in Salzburg, the IMLS and something called the Global Salzburg Seminars put together something on libraries and museums in an era of participatory culture. And they brought about 53 folks from 24 countries together to talk about, okay, how does a library and a museum function in this world where everyone can tweet, where we're overthrowing governments through Facebook, where people expect to be part and push back and comment and tag and want to be involved? How do we survive that? And there were whole discussions around things like how do we prove value in that world, just a whole range of them. And I was part of a conversation on what are the skills needed by museum professionals and librarians to succeed and work in this world. And so what I want to show you briefly is a sort of sample curriculum that we came up with. And it's very high level. And it says these are the kinds of skills that you need to have as a librarian or museum professional. I'll talk about librarians in this age. And frankly, some of them will not surprise you at all because we started with some pretty basic things like technology. People need to know about technology to function in this environment. Once again, not surprising. But rather than say that means Facebook and Twitter and all that, really that technology was an ability to build a virtual presence and an ability to engage and re-engage and constantly learn new technologies. And then the ability to communicate and teach that to our members, the people who work with us. But once again, I think if we went back to the 1950s, that technology may not have been Twitter and Facebook. It would have been card catalogs and something. So, you know, not terribly on its face radical. I think everyone's going to look at that and go, yeah. Management for participation. Professional competencies. What does it take to know your ethics and your values? And what does it take to know about basic economics and how you build sustainable organizations? Asset management, collection development. Once again, nothing too crazy here. Cultural skills. Now, cultural skills aren't new, but they certainly have a different take to them. And these are intercultural skills where librarians, we're going to have to move across macro and micro cultures as we do our jobs. In macro cultures, like we're dealing with people in Canada, and they're weird. Or we're dealing with people in Missouri, and oh my God. But microcultures and the fact that we're dealing with these are the connected kids, these are the disconnected kids, these are the faculty members who get it, these are the faculty members in science, these are the faculty members in humanities, and each of those have their own culture. And as we interact with them, as we seek to accomplish our mission, we need to be culturally sensitive to the language they use, to the norms, to the expectations, to even status within that culture. So, knowledge, learning, innovation. We have to understand that librarianship has always been, but is especially now in the learning business, that our job is to help people learn. It's not to give them information that they will take, that somewhere else they will learn. We are directly involved in their learning. when someone comes and asks us a question, even if it's about a nonfiction book or a fiction book or their dissertation, we're part of the learning process. This is becoming much more true when you look at things like how we accredit libraries, how the middle states and the different regional accrediting bodies coming to universities are talking about outcomes versus outputs. And it's making it rather uncomfortable for some libraries because we've never had to really say, well, the reason that student got the A in their course was because of me at this percentage. We've always been sort of an assumed benefit, and now we're being asked to really, through assessment, prove that we've had impact within the curriculum. And that's new for us. But I'll tell you, we're not going to be able to answer that challenge and make that case if we focus on the stuff. If we focus on how we catalog and we focus on where the books are and we focus on gate counts, we can't make that argument. Frankly, we shouldn't be making that argument. I was talking with a large academic library director, and he said, you know, for years and years, we used to love presenting statistics in our annual reports because they were always going up. Circulation was going up. Entrance was going up. God knows database usage were going up, and we loved putting them. And now within the past 5 years, we've sort of not. Because those numbers aren't going up. Reference questions aren't going up. And what we need to do is find out, well, those were convenient numbers, but what are the real numbers? What is the case we're making? Because I'll tell you, it's not that we're less value or less worthwhile. It's just that it's not happening where it's easily countable. So we need to understand how learning occurs, not simply how materials get sorted and organized. But I really wanted to bring this slide up for that last bullet. That last bullet to me is the most fundamental outcome of this whole talk in Salzburg. And that was that as librarians, we need to understand and be part of transformative social engagement, which is a big mouthful. But what it means is that our role is not simply to inform. Our role is not simply to provide access. Our role is not a platform. Our role is transformation. That when we do our jobs well, we change lives. And I just want to sort of blow that out. These were some of the subtopics that we talked about in there. That we as librarians need to understand activism. We need to look at things like the Occupy Everything movement and understand how it works and why it works. I'm not asking you to agree with the politics. I'm not asking you to go out and, you know, start holding banners. But the idea is to understand that we need to get people moving, that we need to understand advocacy. As librarians, we need to understand how to get organizing communities into action, how we help influence policy, how we help influence politics, how we help influence what the community needs. That we as professionals need to understand social responsibility. We need to do critical social analysis where we go in and we understand culture. We understand what is it that our communities are trying to do. Get out of our buildings and into the minds of the students in the academy and understand what their larger agenda is and fit into it. That we need to understand how to sustain a social mission over time. That we also then need to figure out how to do conflict management. And the way you do conflict management is not to say, oh, there's a conflict, let's leave. I was talking to a student who just came back from a regional conference, and she said she was terribly horrified because she was talking with she was at a session with the head of security for a public library, and he was talking about the problematic people. And one of the groups of problematic people were teenagers. And if you have a teenager, you understand the problems. But what his solution was as security was to get it off premises, that if they were being disruptive, get them off premise. That was his solution. And so he told the story about how this group of older kids was picking on a little younger kid. In teenagers. And he then went to get them off premise. And then the little kid managed to pull a gun, which was nice, and he sort of chuckled at that. And the student came back horrified. She goes, one, that you could look at the idea that this kid had a gun as somehow a humorous experience. But the other one was, before the gun, his answer to a bullying technique, his answer to a conflict was to move it off premise so they could beat them in peace. This is not about conflict management. This is about conflict avoidance. We need to understand that our collection is not the books and materials behind us. Our collection is the community, is the people coming to our doors. And if they have a problem, if they have a conflict, that's our problem. That's part of a problem with our collection, not the stuff, but with the community. And so we need to be able to go in and understand, mediate, facilitate, and work in that environment. We need to understand our community needs at a much more fundamental level. So what I want to just talk about in that move now is to talk about how service, which is the core of all of these things, is proactive. How we look at service as a transformative activity, not simply a passive wait for a question activity. So for example, many of you probably have a sign somewhere near a copy machine that looks roughly like this, right? Copyright. Notice the copyright law of the United States, even the title and code number, governs the making of photocopies and other reproductions of copyright material. A person using this equipment is liable for any infringement, right? This is a sign that says, it's not my problem, it's yours. And we can look at this, and so I don't want to, you know, well, we can look at this and say, well, what is the use of this sign? Does it truly excuse what we're going to do? Does it truly prevent copying? And the other one is, isn't this really reinforcement of a particular view of copyright? Right? This is, yes, there's a law behind it, but do we add another sign underneath that says, but let me tell you about fair use in the Creative Commons? Right? The first one where we just put up the sign is us reinforcing this regime that says, you know, you can't copy Mickey Mouse because it's owned. You can't do this. You can't do that. In essence, we're in a consumer culture that intellectual property is property and it must be protected at all costs. When what we really need to be doing is working with our community so that they understand that, one, what is our view of copyright? And copyright doesn't cover ideas, it covers expressions. How do we as a community, as a culture, work with this, build this idea of sharing and intermixing and bring the values of librarianship right front and forward? Right? So this is about being proactive. This is about working to solve problems, but working with a community to truly understand a new dialogue. And that dialogue is not your only response to society is to pay for it. Your response to society is to create it, to be part of it. We need to bring our values of sharing right front and forward to these folks and say, we're not the copyright cops. We're the idea folks. We want to facilitate and move it. Yes, we work within a legal structure, but frankly, that legal structure was created by our representatives and we should be part of the solution. So this is the kind of thing about pushing it a little further, right? This is another one. This sign, you know, everyone loves this sign. The FBI has not been here. And then in little text, watch very closely for the removal of this sign. I have to say, I was extraordinarily proud of the library profession around the Patriot Act. That we were active in discussing and shaping and talking about the consequences. And even if we don't feel we won that battle, because there's still one, we certainly changed the discussion. We changed the dialogue. And that's, to me, a great victory for librarianship. But where can we go from here? How can we take this idea of being more proactive? Well, for example, when someone comes in and they're worried about privacy, do we as a library give them any choice in the matter? In other words, do we care about privacy so much? It's so fundamental to us that we don't even talk about it with our members. That when they come in and check out a book, we purge their records within 2 days just in case anyone's ever going to look at it. Do we actually educate people on this? My favorite is, we do not keep your records. Everything you do is private. When you're on our catalog, when you're on the integrated library system, and you're searching, we do not keep records of this. Do we tell them that their internet service provider or the networking folks at the university can actually keep every keystroke and probably do and can turn it over with a letter to the FBI and you'll never know? Do we actually talk about what it means? Do we go to the point of saying, but if you want to truly preserve your privacy, let me tell you about Tor. Tor is a whole network of proxy servers built to anonymize web transactions. If you really want to come in here and not have anyone follow your digital lines, do we teach them about how to do that? Do we teach them about the implications? When we put on Facebook, do we walk through, not simply saying Facebook about privacy, bad, or do we go in and say, well, here are the settings and how they work and what it means, and then all of this, that we're proactive. So let's kick it up a notch, as it were. And I want you to think for a moment about a facility like this. Now, this is the University of Kentucky, but my guess is that several people on this call have facilities like this. These are the Commons. And what's interesting about the Commons is not about stuff. The Commons is about activity. It's a sort of library as verb. That you'll notice in this one, there is not a piece of furniture that it doesn't have a wheel on the bottom to move it around. And it wasn't just about the Commons idea as portrayed isn't just about a good place for students to meet and hang out or convenient so they can talk to a librarian and a tech support and a tutoring person. It was also about the idea of creation. It was also about the idea that the center of the library is a community where they're working together and talking together and interacting together. And to me, one of the most interesting things was it was about breaking borders. that what we did with the commons ideas, we said, look, we have the facilities. We need less and less of those facilities to do our job. Right? The library used to be the infrastructure necessary for a librarian to do their job. Now, a lot of that's digital, a lot of that's on the web, a lot of that's portable. We don't need as much space as we used to. And I know you're going to talk to me about your shelving overruns and all of that. But still, think about if you took every database you have in there and you wanted a physical copy of every article, it would be nuts. And so many libraries are looking at it and saying, if we need less space for us to do our job, why don't we turn that space over to the community to do their job? For students to meet in teams, for professors to work with small groups, whatever it is. And what I also love about this is it's about breaking down borders. That with the commons community, what we began doing was not only inviting the community in to use it in non-library matters, but we were inviting other parts of the university to come in and be part of it too. Right? The librarian was sitting next to IT support, was sitting next to academic support. These great, huge walls that we used to put up around our libraries, and not just physical walls, but policy walls, mental walls, began to break down. We began to understand that once we break through boundaries, once we do true partnerships with other people, we get better. Once again, taking what we learned in good consortial activities and expanding the consortia to include non-library settings, non-library activities, bringing them in because we became centered on the member and what they needed to know. Now, I just want to throw a sort of curveball in here for a moment to think even more proactively than this. This is the prejudiced library. This is happening throughout Europe. It's happening in museums and it's happening in libraries. And talking about breaking boundaries, so excuse me, it's a bit of a digression, but it's so worth it. The prejudiced library idea is that as communities, we build up these boundaries, cultural boundaries all the time. And we see that. We see, you know, and we begin to reinforce and balkanize them. To me, this is why I hate the millennial conversation, because it treats anyone born, you know, after 1990 as some mutant people who are different than us that have different brains and their thumbs move differently and all this other stuff. What that, we like to present that in a sort of self-deprecating way where we go, they're different and we need to serve them and their needs. But really what you're saying is they're not us. You're building a boundary between you that you may want to try and cross, but you're also saying, wait a minute, I used to be the mutant. I used to be the one with the crazy idea. I was the one that figured out the Commodore 64. Before that, I was the one who was reading the Little Red Book or whatever it was. Let's just face it. If you're under 18, you're a weirdo mutant. Just deal with it. Every generation has one. And so as you look at these cultural boundaries, we build them everywhere. We build them between faculty like this and library like this and student like this and UGG administrators. And we build these boundaries over and over again. And the prejudiced library is a way that people in the social environment and humanities environment were trying to break those down. What you could do, you've probably heard in the States they have the idea that you can check out someone, check out a person. So you can check out a fireman, you can check out a lawyer, you can check out an accountant, you can do all this wonderful stuff. Well, these prejudice libraries, you can check out a prejudice. So if you haven't had a really in-depth conversation with someone from a different generation, you can check out someone from a different generation. If you haven't had someone of a different sexual orientation or a different ethnic orientation or a different political orientation, you can, in a civil, protected, safe environment, have conversations with people who are not like you. Religious, interfaith religious dialogues. We can have people that disagree on different topical areas, whatever. And so they're checking out their collection of the community, but they're breaking down these boundaries, breaking down these borders. And I think that that's a really interesting example and one that, frankly, the university is really brilliant at because we have lots of different views and different perspectives that we can make available to our students, our faculty, that we can be the facilitators of this dialogue. And universities have a long tradition in through speaker series of doing this, but we can do it in a very interesting, intimate, civil, safe environment. We can do it one-on-one. And I think that that is an amazing opportunity for librarians when we think about breaking down borders. We've managed now to talk to the IT people. Maybe we can actually talk to the students about what they need in the faculty. Let me give you a couple of other examples of proactive ideas, of being looking at services as a really active thing. So, first of all, I mentioned external, extrinsic motivation, and I mentioned tenure. And this one still bugs me to this day, so I will tell you the story. If you've heard it before, I apologize. But a colleague of mine was going through tenure and I just survived tenure the day before, the year before. And I said, oh, call the library. I can't wait to see what they want to say. So he called the library, said, hi, my name is, I'm going up for tenure, can you help me? And the librarian's answer was, sure, we can help you. Either you or your GA, if you come into the library in about an hour, we can walk you through the different databases and materials you need to do a citation analysis. Now, this bugged me to absolutely no end. I cannot tell you. Because what they were saying is two things. One, go away. I mean, that's really what they were. Two, this was the most important task in this person's life. And it's like, well, you know, sure, we can teach you about an hour. Good luck. But the last one was, in an hour, we can teach you or your GA citation analysis. That we can take the most fundamental skill sitting at the most traditional, long-standing part of librarianship of bibliometrics, that, and we can teach it to you in an hour. How's that for needing a graduate degree? That, you know, if we just train you on Web of Science, you're done. This is crazy. What if we looked at it in a much more proactive way? We know who's going up for tenure. And so why not at the first day of classes, you divvy up the people going up for tenure. You walk to the desk, knock on the door and say, hi, my name's Dave. I'll be your tenure librarian. If you sit down and work with me, and we'll work through your vita, we'll do whatever, and I will do the best damn citation analysis you've ever seen before. Now, the benefits to this are pretty amazing because, one, you can actually find out what they've published, and if you have an institutional repository, you can get that data. But the other one is, if you do a good job, or they've done a good job, really, and you've discovered that, and they get tenure, you are now their best buddy for the rest of their life. They will do anything. They'll give you chocolate. They'll invite you to their classes. This is an important moment. And if they don't, they get kicked off, and they have to leave before they can bet. So take this even one step further, though, that not only can we knock on the door, but I've heard it's, let's just say, other universities, there was an issue with citation analysis where they, more or less, the faculty didn't know how to do it, and when they did it, they didn't necessarily do it, I don't know if I want to bring ethically into this, but let's just leave it at well. That the provost who had to evaluate these, or the promotion and tenure committee that had to evaluate these across disciplines, were getting all different views and senses and how what counts and what doesn't count and how many and all this other stuff. Imagine if the library was sitting there providing these kind of objective citation analysis. If we became part of that process, if the extrinsic motivation, in other words, the tenure person wasn't coming asking for it, but the institution was requiring it, imagine how important that would be within the faculty. A couple other examples, embedded via Twitter. There are many examples now where librarians are becoming embedded in classes. In distance ed classes, it's great because we get on Blackboard, what have you. We can actually interwork with the course, with the instructor, with the students. But in face-to-face classes, what's happening is, a librarian can't necessarily go to all of them, but they can monitor 10 Twitter feeds. And so as you're teaching, as an instructor, as the students, and you raise a question going, oh, I remember this study, but I can't find it, these professors or students are simply tweeting out, hey, blah, blah, blah. And the librarians on the other end are seeing them reacting and sending that information right back. And so within the classroom environment, they're doing fact-checking, they're doing enhancement, they're improving the classroom. So we're able to embed ourselves right in the instructional activity. I believe Drexel and Yale has done this for a while, the concierge for freshmen, that when freshmen come to class, they have an assigned librarian that they have to meet with within the first 2 or 3 weeks, and that librarian will help them go through their courses, will talk about resources they may need, talk about things like plagiarism, talk about things like citation management software that we license, talk about the databases. In essence, get time to help a student integrate into the college experience. And there's a huge gap that we've all identified between a senior in high school and a freshman in college, that there's this switch from ingesting information to critically analyzing information. And if librarians can be there at that twist, if they can be actively working with the students and with the faculty and turning these students into scholars, that's an amazing opportunity and, once again, builds connections, builds respect, adds value. The last one is the notion of a data repository for research. So it's kind of like the twin to the embedding in the classroom. That as a faculty member, I sort of have three jobs, right? I'm a writer, I'm an actor, and I'm a secretary, right? I'm a writer in that I do my research and I get a publisher perish. I'm an actor in that when I go to present lectures or organize the classroom, I'm there to sort of stimulate ideas. And I'm a secretary in that I'm on the governance and serving on committees. Well, I don't think we want to support the secretary role. Because we, you know, those who can't do teach, those who can't do or teach provide resources to the doers and teachers. That's not the world we want to be in. We want to be more proactive in that. And so just like we can be proactive in the classroom, imagine that researchers go do all these studies and they generate data, and the data they're generating is getting bigger and bigger and more complex. What happens to that data? When they have to build a website because they just got this NSF grant, they've got to build a website, and they go to their GA who doesn't know how to build a website, but build a website, and they build a crappy one, and then it never gets updated, and then it disappears, and then they get questions about, well, where's that paper from 3 years ago? Imagine if they went to the library, they said, yep, we can set that up. Would you like Dropbox so you can share files, all this other stuff, and the benefit is you're building your collection from your internal data. You're building that. But let's take that one step further. Just like with tenure, where we could integrate and require it, these professors doing data where they have to get human subjects, for example, they have to go before a review board and say, this is the data I'm going to collect and how I'm going to keep it safe. Well, what it used to mean was a bunch of, you know, file folder boxes sitting in their office and eventually thrown away. But what if we said, you know, you don't have to come up with a new idea every time. We have an institutional repository where you can securely deposit data. It's been audited. NSF loves it, or NIH, or whatever it is. And you can have full access to it. You can even privilege access to your GAs, but then we can control it. As an institution, as a research institution, to go to the different funding bodies to say that we have a coherent, thought-through, well-developed institutional data management policy, which every National Science Foundation grant now requires, is an amazing piece of gold. And you're going ahead and building into what faculty consider the most important thing they do in some cases, and you're there and you're helping. I want to give one more example, and then I'll sort of move to wrapping up, and then hopefully we can have a conversation. So e-science, this is a big push that we have, and e-science is the idea that increasingly people are doing science through virtual machines and data. So, for example, rather than this is how the internet started, which was, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, rather than having to buy an expensive house-sized computer for every university, they said, can't we just buy one and then let people get to it over the network? And that's where the internet started. Well, now they're sharing telescopes, which are slightly bigger and harder to find a place for. They're sharing Arctic research facilities. They're sharing these huge pieces of equipment, very expensive, like accelerators and particle accelerators and smashers and things like that. And they can get to them virtually. But what's also interesting is they're now getting these massive data sets where the research isn't necessarily collecting the data, but it's working through 10 terabytes of data on your different thesis. And so this means that increasingly you have to deal with lots of data and you have to deal with collaboration. And so when you think about collaboration and data, organizing information and people, that sounds familiar. I know a profession like that. What we're now doing is training librarians around this notion of e-science. So we got a National Science Foundation grant to start with four. Three of them were hired out of the program before they got through the first year. The fourth one had the job waiting for them. They were sort of polite and waiting. Right? That we have people saying, you train them, we'll hire them. We'll just take them today. In Johns Hopkins, they're managing librarians whose whole job is this. And these librarians are being hired by laboratories, not libraries. They're being hired because they're helping them find research, conduct research, find the new grants, keep track of the data. It's an amazing opportunity. And it's all about collaboration. So imagine now that if these research labs are doing this, why couldn't you, say, coordinate that activity through the library? So yes, you're going to be working with this laboratory. You're going to be working with this laboratory. They're even going to pay 90% of your salary. But 10% of your salary is going to be working with the library to coordinate so that we can learn from each other, so we can develop new skills, we can constantly understand and educate ourselves, we can share this resource out. So what I want you to think about for a moment is go back to this consortialite, which is, how does a consortia fit it? Well, we've shared books, we share materials, we do interlibrary loan, we share collections, we share digital collections and database licensing and education and resources. Many of us will share reference services and do virtual reference networks. But what about sharing ourselves? So you sit there and you go, I don't have enough money, time, effort, expertise to create an e-science specialty in my library. But maybe if you had one e-science specialist within the consortium that you all shared, and then sharing different topical expertise, sharing different administrative structures. Even things like, well, gee, you know, we all are backing up, have these digital collections. We all have to back them up. Why are we each buying terabyte hard drives and backing them up? Can't we just have a central facility to do it? That just like we broke down boundaries around who gets into the library and out of the library, just like we've talked about breaking down the walls so that we get out and we're interfacing with the different faculty, we can begin breaking down our own institutional boundaries where it makes sense. We still have an identity with our institutions. That's important. But we now have a much richer resource of ourselves to pull from. We can share whole faculty and administrative spots. We can anthropologists. I know many libraries that are now talking about hiring anthropologists to come in and study library usage. They want to know what faculty usage is. They want to know where students are going. They want to know what services they're doing. Well, is every library not going to hire an anthropologist? I'm guessing that there are some people on this call where you're sitting there going, there are two librarians. My next hire, if I ever got another position, would be another librarian. It wouldn't be an anthropologist. But I'd be able to pay for 10% of one, 5% of one, and we can share those together. That we can share an infrastructure. Right now, at Syracuse and universities across the country, they're building these massive scale data centers. They're building huge storage. They're building cloud-based systems. They're building all of the stuff that frankly makes my head spin when I try to understand what the technology is. And I sit there and go, not every university needs to do this. If we could come up with the academic cloud, with the academic shared support system, where we're getting more into data services, preservation services, then what we're doing is we're extending the idea of a consortium past sharing our stuff to truly being breaking down our boundaries so we can work together. And we're doing that because our purpose, our intention, is to create transformational changes within our institutions. That by leveraging our support, our resources, we can make our institutions better. We can give them competitive advantage in the market. We can give them better research. We can give them better opportunities for education and teaching. We can share best practices faster. And that's about participation. And so going back to the mission of libraries, which was to improve society, we don't do that in a passive sort of, yeah, we're here and we know we're useful, but we can't count it to. We're out there. We're active. We have a situation where a librarian right now is doing office hours in our department. And I think that's a great first step. But the next step is to knock on the door of the different faculty members and go, what are you working on? What can I help? Or, these days, look at their blog and their website and say, I notice you're working on it. How about this? Where's this information? Can I provide it? And to be working on projects, to become an integral part of the team, become an integral part of the classes and how they're taught, to not wait for someone to ask me to be part of it, but to go ahead and introduce and invite myself and then prove my value once I'm there. I come back to this idea of expecting more. There's an old joke that goes, what do you call three librarians at a bar? A consortium, right? The library field does have a lot of consortia, but this is a testament to the openness and attitude of sharing in the profession. For decades, libraries have worked across boundaries to better serve our members. We shared through the postal system, then dial-up, now the internet. We built a web of knowledge and resources before there was a World Wide Web. Libraries have a long and proud tradition of thinking beyond our own walls to serve our communities. We should be proud of that history, but we need to expect more. We need our communities to expect more of us. Not do more with less, but rather show the community that we are truly about transformation, not simply information. We need to expect more from Carly. The paradox of success is that work that garnered that success is rarely what works to ensure the future success. In other words, what got you here, what worked really well in the past, we should love it, we should venerate it, we should celebrate it, but it doesn't ensure that it's going to work in the future. It really has created a platform for innovation for doing something new into today. We should expect Carly to challenge and innovate. However, ultimately, we must expect more of ourselves. We must look up from the day-to-day reality of staff shortages, toner cartridges, and cataloging backlogs, and become our own future. We must provide to others and ourselves every day, prove every day that librarianship is not clerical, nor about materials, nor about buildings. Librarianship is about improving society. We must now think about sharing more than just our licenses and loaning our books. We must share authority and responsibility with our communities. We must share our services and expertise with each other. ultimately, we must become a truly open marketplace of ideas. You may have joined Carly to expand your database offerings. Use it now to expand possibilities. You may use Carly to share materials. Now use it to share yourselves and the brilliance of your local communities. We need to expect more, to demonstrate that we can do more, to demonstrate that we can be better in order to get the resources to then accomplish it. We need for people to think of us as the innovation hub, where the librarians are the CIOs, the chief integration officers of ideas and what we can be, that we can demonstrate that librarianship and consortium, all this is not simply a matter of committees and structures and antiquated, you know, bureaucracy, but it is in fact a demonstration of the participation and the dynamic culture of ideas and entrepreneurship that we want to generate within our community. We have economic benefit, we have research benefit, we have instructional benefit, and we're there and we're active and you can see us and we're right present, in-your-face librarianship, if you will. That's where we need to move to. And we need our consortia to be there as well. We need to have each other's backs. Right? Sometimes the power of a consortia isn't being able to borrow a book, but able to find a shoulder to cry on. Sometimes it's being able to say, here's to celebrate innovation, to celebrate what's new. That Carly needs to be a way that we can brag about ourselves and congratulate ourselves, but at the same time try new things. And just like I talked about the role of the libraries help people fail in a safe environment in order to succeed, we need to try lots of stuff. It needs to be a sandbox, an experimental startup company. We need to think of our libraries as one big network startup where we try and we pivot and we experiment and we don't wait for perfect. We go out every day and we have new ideas and we say, I don't have the resources to do it here, but through this network, through this consortium, I can gather the resources. We'll try it for a week. If it doesn't work, we'll move on somewhere else. We don't need to form a 12-person committee. Let's just do it. We have an escrowed startup account so that when a committee on innovation thinks it's a brilliant idea, they can make the loan instantaneously, and it can all happen virtually. This is the world we're moving into, and it's not a scary world. It's not a crazy world. It's not the millennial exchange world. It's the world we wanted. Think about where we are. Think about 20 years ago, if you've been around that long in this field, if I said to you, we can provide resources to people wherever they are around the world instantaneously. We can provide them books in digital format that they can cut and paste and annotate and try new stuff. We can look through whole special collections from across the continent. Imagine if I said that to you. You would have gone, whee, yay. Why is it now that we look at that and go, oh, no, do they need us still? We're the ones who made this happen. We're, this culture that we exist in is the one that we have asked for. And now we need to embrace it and be part of accelerating it and making sure that it preserves a good time.